This is Voices of Our World. I'm your host, Eileen Bott. When asked recently when he expects American forces to fully withdraw from Iraq, President Bush said, "That will be decided by future presidents." That means not on his watch, and if it is broke, someone else will have to fix it. Now, as the list of career military and retired generals grows, asking that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld be replaced, they are facing the criticism that kept them quiet till now, including threats to their financial security. A talking points memo was sent to military brass, not yet vocal, letting them know what their positions should be. Those who call Major General John Batiste, Marine General Anthony Zinni, Army Major General Paul Eaton, Marine Corps Lieutenant General Gregory Newbold, Marine Lieutenant General Paul Van Ripper, and others traitors, are quick to forget who authorized leaking the name of career covert CIA operative Valerie Plame, ending her livelihood and all that went with it. A Department of Defense study showed that 80% of Marines killed by upper body wounds in Iraq between 2003 and 2005 died for the lack of $260 armor plates. 18,000 military protective vests were recalled last November because they weren't adequately bulletproofed. Despite that, the U.S. Army has just outlawed privately purchased body armor. Makes you want to count the Support Our Troops bumper stickers in the Department of Defense parking lot. Paul Rykoff volunteered for active duty after 9/11 and served in Iraq as an infantry platoon leader. Kathy Golden speaks by phone with executive director and founder of the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and author of about to be published Chasing Ghosts, A Soldier's Fight for America from Baghdad to Washington, Paul Rykoff.
I will say this up top. I don't speak for everybody at Maryknoll. Clearly, you don't speak for every soldier ever born either. But you're a good barometer of what a serviceman who's been through war, who's seen war, might be thinking. I worry about the psychological health of our people there. Must they believe in the war? Is that important for them?
I think one of the most effective weapons you can have on the battlefield is a clear and distinct mission. And I think it's been a problem for our troops throughout that there was a shifting rhetoric in the beginning, and it still seems like a shell game to this day. And I think it's important for soldiers like me at the end of the day, and in that unfortunate maybe dying breath or on that late night patrol or when your wife leaves you, you got to ask yourself, you know, why are we doing this? And I think it's been a real discredit to those guys in uniform that if you ask 100 Americans why we're in Iraq, you'd probably get 100 different answers. And I think that's a political problem, but it also becomes a military problem. But at the end of the day, when soldiers are away at war, they don't fight for a political agenda. They don't fight for an administration even. At times, they don't even fight for the flag. What they're ultimately fighting for are the man and the woman next to them, their brothers and sisters in arms, and so that they can come home alive and get back to their families and live a normal life. So, you know, the political stuff is important, but at the end of the day, they're just trying to live for the next 24 hours and make it home. And they have been able to make some progress in the local areas with the Iraqi people, even if it's just handing out a bottle of water to an Iraqi kid. It gives them a sense of achievement, and they know they've made at least a difference in that small area for that person. And that's something that's really wrapped up into who they are and how they view this war. And it's very difficult to untangle those different pieces from the rhetoric that comes out of the White House or the ongoing political dialogue in Congress.
Paul Hackett came pretty close this past year, and everybody's watching him and watching what that may mean, what it may indicate. Any chance that you down the road would run for anything now that you're the go-to guy in many ways?
I don't think so. I mean, first of all, I'm broke, and it looks like you need to have a bit of money to run nowadays. And second of all, I'm an independent, and there's not a lot of opportunities for independent candidates right now. And to be honest with you, I'm just more focused on trying to enable other veterans to be empowered and have positions of influence. I think Paul Hackett's a great story. He's the tip of the iceberg. I think there are going to be a number of other vets coming home who have already declared, and there's about 11 or 12 so far who are going to run for Congress, and I think there are more on the way. And these are people that we should look to for guidance because they've got the credibility that no one else in this country has right now. They've been there. They've been in harm's way, and they understand how Iraq affects the world, how it affects our military, and how it affects our country. And, you know, I don't care what party you're from. When these people talk, you should be listening. And I think they could really help guide us through this dark time and help chart a course for the future.
I've seen the new op-ed ad. It's very, very impressive. And even though it's too late for us to fix anything that is broken, if we had gone with Shinseki's advice a long time ago, if we put in 300,000 people, not 150,000, where would we be now, do you think?
Well, I think we'd have a shot. And I think we'd definitely be ahead of where we are now. You know, I entered Baghdad in the spring of 2003, and I saw that there was a sweet spot that existed on the ground in the summer of 2003. We didn't have enough troops on the ground. That's the bottom line. And to put it in perspective, imagine if you live in New York or Cincinnati and you pulled two-thirds of the cops off the street tomorrow. You'd see the crime rate go up. It'd be a lot more dangerous for people living in that community. And that's what it was like in Baghdad in those opening months. We just didn't have enough people. And we lost a lot of the emotional response that we had from the Iraqi people. They loved us when we got there. That's true. But we had only a few months to try to show them that our way was better than the alternative. And we blew it. And since then, we've been battling uphill to try to reclaim their hearts and minds. Shinseki did call for several hundred thousand troops. The Colin Powell Doctrine requires several hundred thousand troops. But the guys in the administration, most of which have never worn a uniform themselves, thought they knew better. And now we've been paying the price ever since. So I think it's important that this administration and the folks in power in the military recognize that they did screw it up initially. And they admit to the American people, we did screw it up initially, because they've never admitted that there haven't been enough troops there, and everybody on the ground has shown otherwise. So I think if we had more troops on the ground, the bottom line is we definitely have a better chance than we have now. And I think overwhelmingly, it probably would have reduced casualties on both sides.
Paul, Senator John McCain has tried to advance a bill that is essentially an anti-torture bill, and Vice President Cheney is looking for loopholes so that the CIA can continue doing what he wants them to do. He wants some loopholes in that torture situation. How do you feel about that?
I think it's interesting that it's introduced by John McCain, because no one would know more about torture in the Senate than a former POW from Vietnam like John McCain. And I think he's really taking the lead here, and the fact that the administration would even consider vetoing this legislation like they have, I think, is a real, real problem.
If you're just joining us, this is Voices of Our World, and we're talking with founder of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, Paul Rykoff.
And it's critical that we show guidelines for the U.S. military on how to treat our enemy prisoners. That's really what they're asking for. And it hasn't received a lot of attention, but our country has to show the world that Abu Ghraib was unacceptable, not only to our military, but to all Americans, and that our country is learning from our mistakes and turning a new corner. McCain had a great quote where he said, "Our enemy doesn't deserve our sympathy, but it isn't about who they are, it's about who we are." And that's the important point here. We've got to take the high road, and we've got to show that Americans do better than other places, and that we ask for more from our people. And also, there's a military component here. If our enemy knows that they're going to be tortured, or there's a potential for them to be tortured, they're going to fight harder. And on the battlefield, in that last dying breath, if they know they're going to be treated well by Americans, they may give up. And that's to our advantage. And, you know, not to mention the fact that when our soldiers are taken captive, guys like me and my platoon, if they're taken captive, you know, we don't want to be tortured either. So it's important that we set the standard, you know, not only for Iraq, but for the world.
When guys that have never served and have never seen war make decisions about war, what do we do about that? I mean, we can't always have a president who's an ex-military. Shouldn't those decisions belong to people like you who've been there and seen war?
I think it's an important component, absolutely. I don't ask that everybody who serves in the presidency have had to serve, but if you haven't, you know, you need to know your areas of weakness and lean on people who have that level of experience. If I was going to go talk to a group of surgeons, I'd sit down with some doctors and find out about their world, find out about what makes them tick, find out about what med school is like. And I think that our political leaders have to do the same thing with regard to military operations, especially if they don't have the personal credentials. The proof is in the pudding here. I mean, George Bush hadn't served, and his closest ring of advisors hadn't served, and the people that they leaned on to really devise a strategy for war did not serve, and they blew off some of the best military minds in this country. You don't hear about guys like Schwarzkopf involved in the war planning. You know, General Shinseki was run out of town. Mm. General Colin Powell was squeezed into another department. So, you know, when it came down to it, they went with a group of guys who thought they knew better. And that's the same sort of thing that happened in Vietnam, and we know the troubles that we had there. So I think now is the time to really lean on those critical people with military experience and ask them to start to give honest feedback and help us chart a course for the future. Because so far, they've been really censored and squashed any time they've tried to speak against the administration.
Paul, how are we treating veterans as they return home? They're carrying a lot of crap when they come home. How are we treating them? Are they getting what they need?
Well, I think the average American is treating them well and has good intentions, but the system is failing them. The Bush administration underestimated the number of people we need on the ground. We've already discussed that. They underestimated the number of armored Humvees they needed. They underestimated the amount of body armor we'd need. And what I'm here to tell you now is that they've also underestimated the demands that are going to happen on our VA. They've underestimated the number of counselors, the number of beds, the number of physical therapists. There's a wave of veterans coming home to America, and the VA is not ready for it. Over 1.2 million troops have deployed overseas in Afghanistan and Iraq since 9/11, and about 100,000 have already come home for care at the VA. So there's quite a few more that are going to be coming home in the coming years. One in four, according to the Army, may have mental health problems, post-traumatic stress disorder, severe depression. Tens of thousands have been wounded, and those numbers are rising. So there's a tremendous human cost to this war, and what we need is the President and the Congress to show some real leadership and say, look, we're here to tell you that we are committed to veterans. We're going to make it a top priority, because it's not only about veterans. You know, we want to do the right thing by the veterans, and that's important, but you got to look at the other numbers, too, and right now our recruiting numbers for the U.S. Army are in real trouble. The Army and National Guard have missed their annual recruiting numbers. I do think that's in part due to what kids hear about the way veterans are treated. If I come home and I was treated poorly, and I talk about it in the New York Times or on your radio show, a 19-year-old thinking about the Army or the Marine Corps is going to hear that, and it's going to discourage him from joining. So it really becomes a national security issue. And I think it's time for this administration to show some real leadership on veterans' issues.
Paul, lastly, if with the Scooter Libby indictment, if it sort of feels and looks as though there may be an opportunity to start to unravel reasons why we went to war, if it's not looking positive in a couple of months and that does filter into Iraq and our people over there start hearing this, how's that going to affect their job?
Well, you know, I think at the end of the day, they're where they are, and they're focusing on what we call in the military the five-meter target. They're focusing on what's right in front of them. And like I said earlier, a lot of that's just getting their butts home in one piece. But I think we need to get to the bottom of this. We need to know why we were sent halfway around the world, and if it was a mistake, which it looks like it was, there were no weapons of mass destruction, well, who screwed up? I think that's a high level of accountability that we need to demand from our civilian administrators. We have that level of accountability in the military. If you screw up, you and everyone in your unit is usually held accountable, and I think we need that same level of accountability in government. The bottom line is that we were wrong. We said we were going for weapons of mass destruction, and there were no weapons of mass destruction. So who told us that there were? And who's going to be fired, and who's going to be held accountable, and how are we going to prevent this from happening in the future? I think it's absolutely critical to establish that level of trust with the military and with America. It's absolutely critical.
I want to thank, as always, Paul Rykoff. You're the best.
Go to our website, OperationTruth.com. Help us pass the word and continue the fight.
Has our Department of Defense fully supported our troops? Email us at radio@marynoll.org or go to our website, www.voicesofourworld.org. Just click on Contact Us. You can call us at 877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 877-MARYKNOLL. Well, that's all for this week, and thanks for listening. Jeremy Broussard and Paul Rykoff are just two of the voices of our world. And I'm your host, Eileen Bott. This week's show was produced by Kathy Golden, and you heard music today by Smodge. Our website is www.voicesofourworld.org. where you can listen, learn more about today's guests and topics, answer our weekly question, or subscribe to our podcast. Please go to www.voicesofourworld.org. To learn more about Mary Knoll or try Mary Knoll Magazine in English or Spanish, call 877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 877-MARYKNOLL. And please join us next time for more Voices of Our World.